لله وكفى وصلاة والسلام على عباده الذين اكتفى خصوصا على أفضلهم وخاتم النبيين محمد الأمين وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين وبعد. فأعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها الذين آمنوا أطيعوا الله وأطيعوا الرسول وأولي الأمر منكم إلى آخر الآية. All you who believe, obey Allah command and obey the Prophet, the Messenger, a command, and in parenthesis, obey those in authority amongst you, meaning lawfully constituted authority amongst you. إلى آخر الآية سورة النساء. Brother Chairman, Dr. Israr Ahmad, our chief guest, Dr. Khwaja Amjad Saeed, distinguished guests, brothers and sisters. Our subject is the political implications of the abolition of the caliphate. In fact, it comprises two parts. The first would be the theoretical implications, and this is located in Islamic political theory. In this theoretical part, we would have to determine, for example, whether a system of Islamic nation states and an organization which brings them together called the Organization of the Islamic Conference, strange name that, whether this is or can be a valid substitute for Darul Islam, whether the modern parliament can be a valid substitute for the caliphate. These are the kinds of issues which will be examined in the theoretical part of the lecture. But we will not tonight, in this lecture, we will not be dealing with the theoretical part. Instead, we will confine ourselves to the second part of the subject, which is the practical implication of the abolition of the caliphate. Part of the reason for that is because it is easier to deal with the first part in writing than in speaking. The caliphate in Istanbul was abolished on March the 3rd, 1924 by the Young Turks. Who were the Young Turks and why did they abolish it? Was the abolition of the caliphate in Istanbul on March the 3rd, 1924 the end of the caliphate? Let us attempt to answer these questions. Who were the Young Turks? They comprised officers in the Ottoman armed forces, basically officers in the Ottoman armed forces, as well as others who were poets and intellectuals, etc., but who had been targeted and who had embraced the model of a society which had been created by modern Western civilization. And so right there up front, the West had showed its cards that if we want to target you and change you, we're going to begin with your armed forces. The foundation of that model, the Western model, was secularism and was philosophical materialism. The essence of that model was that religion was denied any role in public affairs. Religion was strictly a matter of personal, private relationship between a believer or a group of believers and whichever god or gods or goddesses they wish to worship. The new Western model reduced the office of the Pope to a shadow of its former role in society. Previously, no king could have legitimacy as king unless the Pope had appointed him, and the Pope had put his crown on his head. Napoleon ended that. Napoleon took the crown and put it on his own head. In the new model, the Pope was tolerated in a role in which he presided over religious affairs only, and he was completely excluded from his previous role in public affairs. And so the new model was essentially hostile to religion. It no longer recognized Allah as sovereign. Rather, Allah was relieved of sovereignty, and this was now vested in the people. And they in turn constituted or established the state, and sovereignty was reposed with the state and with its organs, the constitution, parliament, supreme court, government. But this is something that you all know. What perhaps you may not have been consciously aware of is that this is very clearly, from the perspective of Islam, this is clear shirk. The new model was therefore essentially godless. In fact, its basic goal was the destruction of whatever there was in religion which recognized and which submitted to a sacred world, a world beyond the material. Its basic goal in respect of the remnant of religion was to secularize religion. So when it was finished, you would have a new Christianity that all Christians would not be able to recognize. A secularized Christianity, a secularized Judaism, and to secularize all other religions in the world. The new model has been eminently successful in Europe. The French, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution were decisive events which heralded triumph and success for the new model. The success of these revolutions was in fact assured when the secular forces were aligned with and drew inspiration from the amazing scientific revolution which was taking Europe by storm, indeed taking the whole world by storm. In the first lecture, Islam and the End of History, we questioned the capacity of a historico-political analysis to adequately explain this phenomenon. A civilization which previously was based on faith in Christianity, and which had given overt expression to that faith, dramatic expression to that faith, for example, in the Crusades. That civilization is now transformed in one of the strangest revolutions the world has ever seen, transformed totally, completely, into now what now becomes an essentially godless civilization. But more than that, it is not content in just becoming godless. It embarks upon a holy mission to transform all the rest of mankind to the same godless way of life. I have suggested, and I will continue to suggest, that there are actors involved in this. Actors located beyond a normal historical and political investigation. I have suggested that a wall had come down and that the countdown had begun. Allah had ordained it. If you attended the first lecture, you'd know what I'm talking about. In addition to this Western secular influence on the young Turks, who have now embraced this new model of a society, there was also compelling evidence, and I located some of this evidence when I was a student in Geneva, because we had access to the Library of the United Nations in the Palais des Nations, and that library there is far richer than the one in New York, because remember it inherited from the League of Nations. And we had access to the library as doctoral students at the Graduate Institute of International Studies. I found evidence, and if someone has the time to continue the research, I think we should be able to demonstrate compelling evidence that the young Turks were also targeted, were guided, and were supported in a highly surreptitious way by the newly established Zionist movement. 1898, the Zionist movement was established. Something else happened in 1898, do you remember? The body of Pharaoh was discovered. And so, between the young Turks and the Zionists, a link was established. And it is amazing that link still flourishes today. When Necmettin Erbakan became Prime Minister of Turkey, was it last year? While Necmettin was still Prime Minister of Turkey, the Turkish armed forces were conducting a foreign policy completely different to his. That finally culminated in a defense pact between Turkey and Israel. Islamic Muslim Turkey, very hostile to Israel, but the Turkey of the young Turks, still continuing to cherish that link with the Zionists, which began while the Caliphate was still existing. The Ottoman Empire was approached. The Caliph was named, I wonder if anybody remembers his name. Very good, Abdul Hamid. Wise man went to Istanbul, the president of the Zionist movement, and made an offer to Abdul Hamid. If you accept this offer, we can be friends. If you reject this offer, we will dispose of you. What is the offer? want to buy Jerusalem. Abdul Hamid responded, Rahimahullah, not all the gold in the world, not for all the gold in the world would I ever part with Jerusalem. And so he had to be targeted. By the Zionist movement, because they wanted Palestine for Israel. But there is also another actor in the field, and that is modern Western civilization, led by Great Britain, which was the only superpower in the world at the time. And modern Western civilization had another goal, not just to get rid of Abdul Hamid, not just to help the Jews to establish the state of Israel, but also to pursue the objective of the universalization of the new model of society. And so the Ottoman Empire was forced into the World War, World War I. They did not want to enter into the World War. This is an area of research which still has to be explored by Islamic scholarship. What were the circumstances which forced the Ottoman Empire against its will into the World War, World War I, and not on the side of the Allied powers, on the side of Germany? In that war, Mustafa Kemal and the Young Turks were eventually able to scramble when Turkish forces were being defeated. And the homeland is now the Turkish homeland itself, when all the rest of the provinces, Syria and Iraq and Jordan and so on, were being lost. And Sharif Hussein had seceded, taken over the Hijaz, cut his links with the Khalifa in Istanbul. Now, at this critical moment, when all that is left is the Turkish homeland, now Mustafa Kemal takes control, and he's able to defeat the British at Gallipoli. He becomes the hero. Something a little strange there at Gallipoli. He becomes the hero. He takes over the Ottoman Empire, which is now no longer an empire. It's lost. The empire is lost. And he takes control of the state. But Abdul Hamid is no longer there, now it is Abdul Majid. What to do with the Khalifa? Allahumma jalla bi'alim. Mustafa Kemal has as his objective, remember, to transform Turkey into a new modern Western model of a state, secular state. What to do with Abdul Hamid, the Khalifa? The answer was, we just make him another pope. The Western model has a pope. And so the Muslim model, the new Muslim model in Turkey, can also have a pope. And so Abdul Majid in 1922 is relieved of his authority over public affairs. And he's assigned a role similar to the Pope. From 1922 to 1924, we had an Islamic Pope. In 1924, Mustafa Kemal was forced to abandon that. One part of the Western model, in which you have the Pope, that is now abandoned. And the Caliphate itself is abolished. Why? You'll be surprised, you sitting here in Lahore. The reason for that abolition of the Caliphate came right here from India. The Indian Muslim community in the 1920s was the most important, the most significant Muslim community in the world, even the most influential. The Muslim community in India had responded to the attack on the institution of the Caliphate with a movement with which you are familiar, the Khilafat movement. That Khilafat movement in India was creating problems for Mustafa Kemal. Then two very influential Indian Muslims decided to make a move. Two very influential Indian Muslims made a move. They issued a joint statement and they chose the relevant time for the place to publish that joint statement so it could have maximum effect around the world. They were the Agha Khan, that's the grandfather of Karim Agha Khan, and Sayyid Amir Ali, the famous judge who had written those two famous books, The Spirit of Islam and Short History of the Saracens. All of India had protested to what was being done to the caliphate. I have not as yet found any evidence of Iqbal protesting. I wish I could find the evidence. But all of India had protested to what was being done to the caliphate during this 1922 to 1924. But these two took the issue to the international plane. When that statement was published in the London Times, that was the last straw for Mustafa Kemal. He felt that this now had the capacity to destabilize his regime and the model that he's trying to create. And so, on the 3rd of March, he decided to whip the potential danger in the bud, and that was the reason why the Grand National Assembly, that's what it was called in Angola, now it's called Ankara, adopted the resolution on the 3rd of March to abolish even the Pope Caliphate. Now, political analysis. Had the Istanbul Caliphate of 1922 to 1924, the Pope Caliph, had it not been abolished, had it survived, had the Indian Muslims not made that threat which Mustafa Kemal could not take, then that Pope Caliph would have been a greater tragedy for Islam than the total abolition of the caliphate. Because the Pope Caliph, in the office of the caliphate, would have been used by the West and would have been used by Israel to provide very important cover of religious legitimacy for two things. Number one, the effort to secularize Muslim society around the world. Number two, the effort to establish legitimacy for the state of Israel, which is to be established. And so, وَعَسَىٰ أَن تَكْرَهُ شَيْئًا وَهُوَ خَيْرٌ لَكُمْ. It may be that you dislike something, but in it there is benefit for you. Now then, was the abolition of the Istanbul Caliphate on the 3rd of March 1924 the end of the caliphate? 99 out of 100 Muslims would say yes. For all practical purposes, until Mahdi comes, that's the end. Very few would know that on March the 7th, 1924, Sharif Hussein, who had been appointed by Abdul-Hamid as the Sharif of the Hijaz, Makkah and Medina, Taif and so on, Sharif Hussein, who had severed his links with Istanbul and joined the British in 1916, Lawrence of Arabia, remember him, same Sharif Hussein, Hashimite from Banu Hashim, now claims the caliphate. 7th of March 1924. This is an Arab caliphate. This is a caliphate of the Quraysh. He's Quraysi. This is a caliphate of Banu Hashim. He's from Banu Hashim. This is the caliphate of a man who already controls the Hijaz, already controls Mecca and Medina, already controls the Hajj. He has everything on his side. And this is also a chamcha of the British. So he has the support of the biggest superpower in the world. What could possibly go wrong? He should succeed now as Khalifa. The Hijaz accepted his claim to caliphate. It's a good beginning. One of the most important religious personalities outside of the Hijaz and adjacent to it, the chief Qadi of what was then known as Transjordan, accepted Hussein as Khalifa, which was a very important feather in his cap. Now, if the attack on the caliphate in Istanbul was a purely domestic Turkish phenomenon attributed solely to Mustafa Kemal and his young Turks, then there should be, or there should have been, no obstacle for the caliphate to now be relocated in Mecca. The Turks don't want it. But it did not. The Hijazi caliphate was ruthlessly targeted and ruthlessly destroyed after just a few months. Why? How? Who did it? In answering those questions, we come to important political considerations as to why was the caliphate abolished. A true picture and a larger picture now emerges. This is the picture. We wanted the caliphate as a papacy, the Pope. If it cannot exist as a Pope, it would not be allowed to exist. Nowhere on the face of the earth. Two forces are at work, which have determined that any semblance of a royal caliphate must not be allowed to survive anywhere on the earth. The first is modern Western civilization. The second is the Zionist movement. And behind these two are two transcendental forces at work. If you did not attend the first lecture, you would not understand what I'm talking about. The Quran speaks of Ya'juj and Ma'juj, so I'm allowed to speak about it. You may differ with me, it's my opinion. The Prophet speaks about Dajjal, I'm allowed to speak about it. There are the forces behind these two. The attack is to ensure that the caliphate is destroyed. But now, after some time, a third force joins these two to ensure that the caliphate, once destroyed, can never be restored. My view is that that third force is Hindu India. I would share with you in a while something that happened in Rabat, how the Indian behaved in Rabat. Allah will eventually remove all these three obstacles. We will come back to the questions in a moment. Allah will eventually remove all these three obstacles. The obstacle of the modern West, the obstacle of the state of Israel, and the obstacle of Hindu India standing in the way of the restoration of the Caliphate. And inshallah the Caliphate will be restored. Number one, the Western world will self-destruct. It appears through disease. Number two, a Muslim army will defeat Hindu India. Number three, a Muslim army will defeat the state of Israel. The Khalifa who will emerge and who will lead us to these victories is Imam Mahdi.